طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media, and that is why we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. And this is your host, John Roberts. The Harvard College Palestine Solidarity Committee held several events during Israeli Apartheid Week, including an evening with Palestinian poet Remy Kanazi. Kanazi is a tour de force, a bundle of energy who is part poet, part stand-up comedian, and part social commentator. All three parts are evident in his performances. We begin this morning's program with an excerpt from his brilliant performance at Harvard.
I'm Palestinian. My parents and grandparents are refugees from 1948, so I guess I'll start at the beginning. Basically, I'm going to do like some poetry tonight, then maybe we'll do a Q&A if you want to grab a book afterwards. But I'm basically, like, the poems are going to be like angry, angrier, and angriest, because that's my spectrum of emotions. The first piece I'm going to start with is called Refugee. For the other 11 people that don't know, from 1947 to 1949, 750,000 Palestinians were ethnically cleansed from their land. Over 500 villages were destroyed to make way for what became the State of Israel. In Arabic, we call it the Nakba. In English, it quite literally translates to catastrophe. But it's important that when we talk about the Nakba, that we not relegate it to one moment in the past and disconnect it from waves of ethnic cleansing that have taken place over the last 70 years, or the fact that today 7 million plus Palestinian refugees can't return to their homes and lands. So the first piece I'm going to do is called Refugee, and it's the story of a father who was a child at the time, who was ethnically cleansed in 1948, and the story of his daughter, who's living under direct military occupation and has never been back to where her father was ethnically cleansed from. So I mentioned 1948. In 1967, Israel occupied the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, East Jerusalem, the Golan Heights. And so you could live in the West Bank and be 28 miles from where your parents were kicked out from and have never been there because of military occupation, a series of checkpoints in an Israeli state that controls your movement. She's never seen the sea. Sunlight imprinted on her father's skin. Waves crashing at his feet, smile tattooed underneath boyish grin. Snapping pictures with closing eyes. Her father's face flush on recollection, the same waves that had clenched like an angry jaw as his mother pushed him forward like a train car. Watch his neighbor drown, tears streaming, eyes connecting, screams muffled, as inhalation suffocated, lungs, muscles, weary, skin, pruning. He was barely a boy, knowing he'd never return. His neighbor, an older man, born in Akka, looked dapper at dinner parties, looked helpless that day. His body revolting against death, a pool intent on swallowing him, so many stroking to get on boats departing. Who'd have known? This gulf would have been their deathbed. She has been beaten, ID checked, body thrown to the ground, fists and feet pummeled, tender flesh, shoulder broken, heart too many times. Tear gas inscribed on her lungs. She wrote back on her breath that the canister's defeat is near. These fields are ours, she said to me. Before the Europeans and Brooklynites, before the swimming pools, army jeeps, and barbed wires, before the talks, roadmaps, and Swiss cheese plants, before declarations rewrote history, those hills meant footprints, and that can't be erased. Like village massacres can't be erased. Like broken bones policies can't be erased. like the screams, ringing in our father's ears, can't be erased. We're the boat returned to dock. We're the footprints on the northern trail. We're the iron coloring the soil. We cannot be erased.
That was Palestinian poet Remy Kanazi speaking at Harvard University. And now our feature presentation, which was held at Tufts University as part of their recognition of Israeli Apartheid Week. Nora Erekat and Khoury Peterson-Smith spoke on Palestinian Black Solidarity. It begins with introductions by Tufts professor Tom Aboud.
Welcome, everyone. It's, as the student said, a great way to, it's great to see community and university folks here, and I really appreciate you all making it tonight, and you will not be disappointed. It's really a great pleasure and indeed an honor to welcome two intellectuals who combine really radical activist commitments and brilliant scholarly and intellectual talent as well. This is not always the case, but it is the case tonight. We have two incredible activists as well as scholars with us, and it's really so wonderful, Noura and Khoury, to have you here. I want to waste no more time except to introduce our guests, and then the format for tonight, before I introduce them, let me just say that each of our speakers will make some opening remarks, and then we're going to have a little bit of a discussion and dialogue. They'll have a discussion and dialogue between themselves, which will then branch out into a conversation with all of us about some of the crucial themes and ideas around colonialism, race, Palestine, and white supremacy in the United States. Noura Erekat is a human rights attorney and an assistant professor at George Mason University's School of Integrative Studies. Her research, really, there's no bios that could sum up and summarize the immense sort of CVs of both these speakers, but this is an extract. Noura's research interests include humanitarian law, refugee law, national security law, and critical race theory. Noura is the author of the newly printed Justice for Some, Law in the Question of Palestine from Stanford University Press. Congratulations. Okay, go out and get it. I'm in the midst of finding a copy myself. That's really quite wonderful. Congratulations. More recently, Noura released a pedagogical project on the Gaza Strip in Palestine, which includes a short multimedia documentary, Gaza in Context, that rehabilitates Israel's war on Gaza within a settler colonial framework. She's also the producer of the short video Black Palestinian Solidarity, very germane for this evening. Khoury Peterson-Smith is an activist and scholar whose work interrogates U.S. empire. He's the Michael Ratner Middle East Fellow at the Institute for Palestine Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. Khoury researches race and empire and does an absolutely brilliant job of that. I've learned a lot from your work on bases and U.S. imperialism. He also looks at black internationalism and liberation, Palestine borders and migration, and U.S. empire in Asia and the Pacific. Before working at IPS, Khoury was a postdoc fellow in comparative global humanities at the Center for Humanities at Tufts. He is a member of Black for Palestine Network and co-author of the 2015 Black Statement of Solidarity with Palestine, which I recommend to all of your attention. So without further ado, please help me welcoming our two wonderful guests for this evening.
Thank you all so much for coming and for the organizers for making this really really special event happen. And thank you to Amira for offering the land acknowledgement. And I also want to appreciate the fact that we're in the land of Massachusetts people and the Wampanoag and Nipmuc and other regional nations and tribes as well, and that this conversation tonight indeed is taking place in solidarity with Indigenous peoples around the world and in this place. With that, I want to talk about the fact that yesterday the Israel Defense Forces official Twitter page tweeted out an image of the outline of an Iranian woman's body pregnant with the word terror. Some of you may have seen it. The caption reads, "Iran breeding in the Middle East." In so few words and in one image, this tweet signals many things. The first is a reminder that while the entire Israeli project has been catastrophic for the Palestinian people, it has invested tremendous and it has invested tremendous resources in honing violence directed at that population in particular. The purpose of the Israeli state always went beyond Palestinians in the land of Palestine. Israeli hostility to Iran is one example of the state's project in dominating and representing Western geopolitical interests in the Middle East region. That has certainly informed U.S. support for the Israeli project. While the United States has a strong affinity for Israel as another imperial settler colonial state, its level of investment in the Israeli project flows from the significance of such a strong ally in what has been the most geopolitically strategic region of the world from the perspective of U.S. empire, the Middle East, by virtue of the enormous oil reserves located in the region. The U.S. and Israeli contempt for Iran in particular has oriented the two states since the 1979 revolution in that country deposed the three-decades-long U.S.-backed dictatorship, taking Iran out of the U.S. and Western orbit. But the tweet also communicates a long-standing set of tropes regarding Israel's attitude about reproduction in nations that it classifies as enemies. A central theme in Israeli colonial discourse has been the supposed problems with Palestinian reproduction in particular. For years, there has been a very public conversation among Israeli politicians, in the Israeli media and society about the Palestinian so-called demographic problem. The liberal version of this notion identifies rising Palestinian birth rates and asks how Israel will maintain the integrity of a Jewish state in a place where the Jewish population will be outnumbered. Whatever the framing, whether liberal or more openly right-wing, the question of Palestinian fertility, particularly the fertility of Palestinian women, is identified as a threat. This is combined with tropes about how Palestinians raise their children to hate, teach terror, etc. The point being that all Palestinians, and particularly Palestinian children and childbearing women, constitute a threat to Israel. A stark example of this understanding came with the sale of a popular T-shirt during the 2008-2009 Israeli war on Gaza that had the image of a pregnant hijabi Palestinian woman in the crosshairs of a gun with the text, "One shot, two kills." There is so much to say about this, but for the purposes of our conversation here tonight, it calls to mind the tropes deployed against black women in the United States, whose fertility is also considered a threat in the criminalization of black children and youth. These include the tropes of the welfare queen, crack babies, super predators, tropes that alternatively cast black children as victims of and perpetrators of black criminality. In any case, as with Palestinians, it is our very reproduction, and particularly the fertility of women, black women, that constitutes the threat to this society, and the dominant institutions of this country are concerned with managing us as a population. That is the dark part of the black-Palestine connection or nexus, from criminalization to the politics of reproduction to our being cast as hopelessly and culturally violent, which justifies institutions of state violence being developed against us, shaping our social worlds, etc. Black people here and Palestinians have much in common. Moreover, the U.S. and Israeli governments at every level cooperate in the shared projects of controlling each population. And the conversation that my comrades who introduced this discussion spoke to about deadly exchange, about the fact that U.S. police departments send cops, including university police departments, send cops to Israel to train because Israel markets itself as specializing in policing based on the experience of managing the Palestinian population, and that those tactics and strategies are then imported back to the United States, speak to the kind of cooperation that exists between the different states at the national and local levels. The flip side of this, however, is a rich history of cooperation and mutual identification between black people here and Palestinians. And I want to say a word about this conversation. The conversation about black Palestine solidarity is not a new one. We are in the latest wave of what has been a kind of ongoing history. And that this current wave is in a particularly interesting moment because there were some kind of milestones, for example, the Ferguson Uprising in 2014, which came in the very same summer as the latest Israeli attack on Gaza at that time. And so I remember, and I'm sure people in this room remember, watching the news to see the latest unfolding from the Israeli savage attack on Gaza, and then the same news broadcast reporting on the uprising in Ferguson. And the fact that Palestinians in Palestine and Palestinians here in the U.S. and actually in Ferguson were extending solidarity to the black struggle here. And in truth, the 2015 statement that I worked on with other black activists, the origins really, they were in 2014 when we saw not one, but two statements from Palestine in solidarity with the black struggle here. And we said, well, what are we doing to extend solidarity from black folks here to Palestine? And that's when we started to work on this statement, right? So that was one milestone in this latest wave of a conversation. But even as Ferguson rose up and as Palestinians resisted the attack in Gaza and so on, the conversation about black Palestine solidarity, about that connection, felt like it was happening among a fairly small group of us. And it was not a terribly public conversation. Bless you. It has moved from those kind of quieter places and fairly small groups of us to now a very public conversation. And it should be said that there was, even this latest wave and what happened in 2014, there was a prehistory that involved people like Cornel West, like Angela Davis, other prominent black public intellectuals taking a stand for Palestine. But then, again, we were having these, as fairly small groups of activists and scholars, having these conversations about black Palestine solidarity. And it's funny, I was talking to a friend in the Black for Palestine Network who was talking about when we started this work in 2015 and feeling like it kind of, in the public eye, was kind of going unnoticed. And then folks may know that our organization was mentioned in like the New York Times Magazine last week. So we went from like a fairly small kind of conversation to a very public one. And milestones in that kind of new moment in the conversation include the speech by Mark Lamont Hill on the floor of the United Nations in solidarity with Palestine. The fact that Angela Davis, who again has been was an early proponent of this wave of Black Palestine solidarity, recently awarded a civil rights award in Birmingham. That award rescinded because of her solidarity with Palestine, because of protests by people like us. The award once again extended, though at that point that the ship had sailed. And then, remarkably, and for me, I imagine for others, quite unexpectedly, this extending into the U.S. Congress with Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar. You know, Rashida Tlaib representing a district that is majority black and talking about that explicitly. And of course, Ilhan Omar making history in more ways than one. But one of those ways being talking about the history and current reality of U.S. imperialism and what it does around the world, and in particular, calling attention to Palestine, the Palestinian struggle, and the U.S. support for Israeli apartheid. So it's a new moment, and it's very exciting. I don't want to. We've agreed to give brief kind of opening remarks in favor of a longer conversation. But let me just say a few other things about Black Palestine solidarity. One is, and a few of us were talking about this before this gathering, that the thing about the decision to be in solidarity with the Palestinian struggle for freedom, or be in solidarity with the Black struggle for freedom, is that in making that decision, you are not only deciding to be in solidarity with a group of oppressed people, you are deciding to be in solidarity with a group of resisting people, fighting for our freedom. And that means a very different political orientation. If I can speak briefly about my own experience, I learned about Palestine when I was in high school in a place where I knew no Palestinians, and at a time when it was not popular to be in solidarity with Palestine. And immediately the question that I was forced to answer, which is a question that many people in this room have been forced to answer, Palestinian folks in a particular way, how can you support those terrorists? How can you support their violence? And what that meant was that we have to learn what it means to stand with people who are fighting for their own freedom and defend that right. And that offers a different orientation, not only on their struggle, but really on the world. Particularly when you recognize the level of investment in even preventing a conversation about solidarity from taking place. You can't even talk about the question of Palestine without these kinds of questions and charges, right? Though I believe that by virtue of the solidarity work that we've been building in recent years, we're actually in a different situation where increasingly it's Zionists who are on the defensive. They have to defend the violence of their state. But that thing about what it means to be in solidarity with Black folks or Palestinian folks means that you're in solidarity with resisting peoples, I believe, is part of why the Black-Palestine solidarity nexus is so powerful. There's something about the story of each struggle that is not only rich in and of itself with its own history and its own resistance, but there is something about each struggle that reveals something about the whole nature of not only the politics of the places where they're located, but of the world. And that was what it was for me to learn about and to come into solidarity with Palestinians. It meant learning about structures of world imperialism, actually. So that's one thing. Another thing I want to say about Black Palestine solidarity is that, again, that connection, that nexus is incredibly powerful. But in coming to recognize the significance of Black Palestine solidarity, I want to encourage people not to stay there, but to go beyond. That actually, Black Palestine solidarity is an entry point into a world of solidarity. I believe, for example, if we are going to talk about solidarity with Palestinians, in a country, in a place where we have a president whose signature policy is building a wall on the southern U.S. border, we have to talk about the connection between the wall they are building and the walls that Israel has built. Israel has four walls, by the way. One across the West Bank. They had one in Gaza. They're building another one, actually. They're kind of tearing it up and building a stronger wall. They have a wall on the border with Egypt that's directed at Black migrants coming north, and they're building a wall around the Golan Heights as well. So that's what the Israelis are doing. And Trump and Netanyahu make the connections all the time. Yeah. Netanyahu said when Trump took office, Trump is right, walls work. Trump retweeted his, et cetera, et cetera. So they're making the connections. We have to make the connections as well. If we are talking about the question of refugee migration, which I believe is one of the key questions of our time, facing not only us in this place, but really in every country in the world, then we have to talk about the question of Palestine and the Palestinians. Again, because the states of the world are talking about it, Israel markets itself as a place, as a project that is specialized in controlling the freedom of movement of refugees. And they are lending their expertise to the states of the world. And so we have to also learn from the Palestinian struggle to inform what we say and what we do in solidarity with refugees as well. The last point I want to make is about this question of solidarity, and I want to address a question that came up again in a smaller gathering with activists, but really comes up all the time, which is that if we as activists stand in solidarity with one group of people, does that detract from our struggle? That is, for Black folks to stand in solidarity with Palestinians, does that take away from the Black struggle, and vice versa? And I believe that if we look over the course of the history of Black-Palestine solidarity and look at its highest points, if we look at, for example, the moment of Black power here in this country, which coincided with a high point in the Palestinian freedom struggle, the solidarity that extended between those two freedom struggles didn't detract from each, but actually multiplied the possibilities and the strength of both. And so I invite us to consider that as we build solidarity today. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Khoury. As we would say in the Arab world, here we say, doctor and then last name, but in the Arab world, it's always doctor and then first name. So it's Dr. Khoury. So I want to pick up a little bit on what you've provoked. So much of what you've shared with us is an invitation to think in a particular way. And so I want to think about invitations. What are the invitations of Black Palestinian transnational solidarity? What do they invite us to think about? How do we think about them? So let me say first, overall, one thing that I think has been very clear in the work that I've done as an activist and as a scholar is to think about Black experience and Black liberation struggles in the United States is an invitation to think about white supremacy as a global phenomenon, right? So it's not a U.S.-specific condition, and it's not only a condition that's derivative of a slave economy, right? But race is a social construct, it's constructed in different ways, and we should be able to read it not just through the lens of U.S.-based racism across the world. So we're trying to find, this is what many people in empire will tend to do, is to try to find a reflection of themselves elsewhere. So if racism looks like this in the United States, it must look like that everywhere else, and yet it takes on different dimensions of who is racialized as white, who is racialized as Black, and that's not necessarily reflective of our own experiences. So that's one. How can we be more critical of white supremacy in ways that make us, for example, question Zionism not only as a form of domination that dominates Palestinians and marks them for erasure or elimination in the sense of Patrick Wolf's, the structure of elimination, but also marks Middle Eastern Jews as incapable of existing in Israel as Arab and Jewish. So much so that moniker had to be devastated. Yeah. So that if you were Jewish, and if you were a Jew from Iraq or Syria or Lebanon or Egypt in Israel upon its founding and during its earliest years, you could no longer be Arab Jewish, but you had to be termed something else as the Mizrahim or Jews from the Middle East. Your history, I learned this from Ella Shohat, that your history is one where you now, Middle Eastern Jews or Arab Jews, are no longer have a history in Iraq, but their history becomes a European history, right, of shtetl and programs, right? So that they no longer have the same cultural affiliations. So it's what Shahat describes as a process of self-devastation, right? And that, helps us to think also through, then why are Palestinian citizens of Israel not known as Palestinian citizens of Israel? But they are called the Arab Israelis, right? So that moniker that is impossible for the Middle East, for Jews from the Middle East to have and to own as Arab Jews, now becomes a way of erasing Palestinian nativity and indigeneity so that we come to know them, and this is a very colonial moniker, as Arab Israelis rather than as Palestinians in Israel or Palestinian citizens of Israel. It's a juridical category. It's a juridical category, but not a native one, right? So that's that invitation from thinking about blackness in the United States and black liberation struggle in particular about the battle against white supremacy, right? And I would say, and this is going to be part of my self-critique. I don't want to get there just yet. I'm trying to be organized a little bit and tell you about the self-critique at the end, but let's put a pin in it. How much of that work has the Palestinian community done in North America or in Palestine to think, to receive that invitation and to think through that? And so that's that. I'm just going to put a pin in that. The other invitation that is presented to us is what Palestine gives us. And especially for people based in the United States, this is, as Dr. Khoury vividly expressed in his high school years, thinking about Palestine as an invitation to question empire, right? It begins to run our imagination that the horizon of equality and freedom is not one embodied by political sovereignty in the United States, that we are all here to be equal and to fulfill the demands of the Constitution, but instead that that isn't the horizon when the rest of the world is subject to rampage, to removal, to warfare, to war profiteering, to extraction of natural resources, as the empire grows, and this is the work of Aziz Rana, who shows us the two faces of American empire, that as the empire grows in the United States across the settler colony, more people can be included in our polity, and now we've stretched across the world and we're as we expand empire in that way, but there's a limit, and suddenly that polity also becomes limited of who can be included within the United States. So it's that invitation not just to think about Israel's domination of Palestinians, but why is Israel really receiving $3.8 billion of aid annually when it's listed as something as either number 23 or the 27th richest nation in the world? That's not, and it's small. Surely they don't need that. What is going on there? What is the relationship between Israel's presence and its establishment and the way that the United States comes to establish under the Lyndon B. Johnson administration in the aftermath of the 1967 war, Israel's qualitative military edge, which ensures that Israel will be capable of militarily defeating any single Arab nation alone or collectively? What is the U.S.'s investment in that after 1967? My short answer to that is to say that the 1967 war revealed to the United States that the former policy of maintaining a stalemate between Arab-compliant monarchies, right, and Israel, so that they were always, in conflict, which maintained the status quo, basically peaceful hostility, right, of deterrence, that was no longer necessary after Israel was able to defeat several Arab armies. That now the U.S. saw in Israel an asset, a Cold War asset, that it hadn't imagined before, and this is what begins our relationship and our relationship to Israel as empire. Now that relationship shifts over time. Let me go there and then go back to thinking about Israel's empire. But shifting over time, why am I saying that? Because in the present, many people who are especially thinking about Ilhan Omar and thinking about the attack of her on Congress are very much convinced that this is basically the Israel lobby's influence. That but for the Israel lobby, the U.S. would have probably, congresspersons would have applauded for Ilhan Omar and supported her.
Right?
But that's crazy talk. That is not the influence of the Israel lobby alone. Certainly it's influential, but that's to overinflate its power. That's actually a defeatist attitude of who our adversary is, because a few things. Number one, let's start by just acknowledging what we've been told. We are a settler colony. The investment that we have in protecting other settler colonies is a personal one. It's why you find that Canada and Australia are falling into line with U.S. imperial interventions in regards to Israel and Palestine in ways that other countries are not invested. Number two, we maintain a racial caste system, one that we have exported and produced. You know, what we know as Jim Crow, if we were to study it under an international law framework, we would describe as apartheid in this country. right? And so that kind of investment that we have in protecting ourselves is what would make the United States reticent to go and criticize a settler, colonial, racist regime. It would be ludicrous to do that work and not become a lot more self-critical here in the United States. So that's just a piece of it, right? And we can talk about that. This is also an invitation for you to start up conversations with us. But the second thing that I want to say is that the Cold War ends in the early 1990s, and the U.S. emerges as a unipolar, you know, we emerge in a unipolar world. The U.S. is a singular power. It's an empire now. So if we no longer have the need for Israel and a Cold War struggle because we've prevailed, then why the continuing investment since the early 1990s? How do we explain that? And so much of what I study and draw from, and Amy Kaplan at UPenn has shown us this as well, Israel has been very much become part of a cultural discourse in the United States, not just a political one, right? Most people don't understand the political one, but very much understand the cultural identification that we have with Israel. We have the mythology of a people seeking a land without a people for a people without a land. We have mythologies that have been created about, expanding the frontier, you know, this westward expansion or pioneering. These are pioneers in the region. We also have a relationship and an imaginary about Israel as a white European state in the Middle East, and understand it as within an Islamophobic framework as the easternmost front against Muslim terrorists who are coming to attack us. So there is a relationship that we have with Israel that's deeply embedded in cultural, that absent a political analysis, there'd still be an affinity to this construction. And I say that only to say that let us not overinflate the Israel lobby's power. Right? Let's not overinflate that. If it's kind of the same way that that would be a straw man argument, in my opinion. I think the Israel lobby is influential. Don't get me wrong. I worked on the Hill for 2 years trying to figure this out for myself. Right? How does power work? And I had many members tell me, we would say more. Right? We would say more. But their other critique is we would say more if you were more politically organized. Right? So it wasn't just about the lobby. It was also about the lack of organization. Formal political organization of an anti-imperialist camp that doesn't go to Congress. Shocker. Shocker, right? But as Stephen Walt and John Mersheimer have shown us, there are moments where U.S. and Israeli policy has diverged in the Middle East, right? And in those instances of divergence, when the U.S. still acts against its interests, then that differential is when we can identify the influence of the lobby. So rather than see everything that the U.S. is doing as doing Israel's bidding, instead we should understand it as Israel fulfilling, the U.S. fulfilling its own interests. And in those instances where those interests do not converge, that's when we can identify that differential as the Israel lobby influence. Okay. That was the intro. So I don't think I'm going to have time to do what I wanted to do. But the other invitation that I had, just go on. Okay, not too much. The other invitation that I heard was an invitation to think about resistance as opposed to thinking about oppression, right? So how is it that we would change our story? Why is it we talk about Israel so much instead of talking about Palestinians? We talk about Israel much more than we talk about Palestinians. We talk about the U.S. and the police much more than we talk about black communities, right? So what happens when we center resistance as our point of departure? So one thing, and so here I'll just maybe just set this up, and rather than go into detail, I'll set it up as a timeline of how I think about Palestinian epics of resistance and where black Palestinian solidarity has a historical legacy that we can then continue, yes? So Palestine, as a former Ottoman Empire, it's designated by the British for Jewish settlement in a proclamation, in a letter, in 1917 that is then approved by British Parliament, known as the Balfour Declaration, that is, then is incorporated verbatim, word for word, incorporated into the Palestine Mandate. The Palestine Mandate is an instrument of the League of Nations, which is established in the aftermath of the First World War in order to usher the former colonies of the Ottoman and the German empires to self-governance. The principle of that, right, when you then incorporate, there's The principle of incorporating, of making the Balfour Declaration part of the Palestine Mandate is now what was formerly British policy of Jewish settlement in the Middle East becomes international law and policy. Right? It now becomes an obligation of the international community to fulfill that settlement and to suspend the right of self-determination for the Palestinians. During that mandate era, right, so between 1917 and 1948, during that mandate, what also known as the interwar years, Palestinians are resisting for recognition and inclusion. They are mostly struggling to be recognized as a rightful sovereigns, just like their counterparts in Lebanon, in Syria, in Iraq, in Egypt. They are being denied the right to self-determination, and it becomes one of proving eligibility. And during that time, we see the first Palestinian Intifada, the Great Revolt, between 1936 and 1939, which was began as a boycott. So thinking about our first boycott and the legacies of boycott, began as a tax boycott and became an all-out revolt, where we see the British enacting policies that they were enacting across the rest of their colonies, specifically emergency laws, which suspend civil administration in order to crush the rebellion. And they crushed at this time, during the Great Revolt, 10% of the Palestinian male population through exile and through murder. And so 10 years later, when Palestinians are attempting to resist Israel's war or the Zionist war to establish Israel, they're basically crushed and unable physically to mount a resistance in this time. So this is the first epic, and we see a type of a resistance through the first kind of revolt, where Palestinians step outside of the respectability politics of telling the international community, include us, include us, include us, where it becomes revolution, and they say, we don't want it. We don't want to be included. We don't want the system. It doesn't work. And there are racial tones, and so part of the legacies of Black Palestinian solidarities are actually planted in this moment, even though they're not translated between Black communities and Palestinians. They're being articulated in the way that we can understand the League of Nations system as a racial system. One that, for example, promised the former Ottoman Empire's sovereignty at some point with some sort of governance, but said that none of the former German colonies in Africa would ever be eligible for self-determination because they were too backwards. So this racial logics we see even embedded in the League of Nations system, and we see an intellectual legacy of the relationship between colonialism and racism. And even here we can see the stratification of Palestinians being designated as racially superior. Even if they're being denied the right to self-determination, they're designated as racially superior. Again, I want to invite to complicate this idea that in Black Palestinian solidarity, there is no equivalence. We can see similarities, we can see parallels, but there's no equivalence to these conditions or these stories. Palestine is a modern phenomenon. We're talking about 102 years, and yet the history of slavery is 400 plus years old, and so these are very different. So how do we maintain that complexity even as we preach and advocate for solidarity? Okay, so let me quickly go through the other moments. The other moment that is incredibly relevant is between 1948 and 1967, where Palestine becomes designated as a refugee problem. That's how we understand Palestine. We're not recognized as juridical people, and in fact, Resolution 242, which ends this 1967 war, and which Jordan and Egypt vote for, enshrines the juridical erasure of Palestinians. The Resolution 242 guarantees that Israel will be recognized as a permanent fact on the ground in the Middle East in exchange for the return to Arab lands, but never articulates that Palestinians have the right to self-determination, and in fact only refers to them as a refugee problem. This is a major shift for Palestinians when they push themselves out of as a derivative of an Arab nationalist movement and articulate themselves as a nationalist movement, as a Palestinian national movement. That when the PLO was established in 1964, it's established by Egypt, by Jamal Abdel Nasser. But it wasn't until 1968 that Arafat, Yasser Arafat, as well as a number of other militant movements, take the helm of the PLO and make it Palestinian. Okay? So this moment is one of the most significant, and when most histories of Black Palestinian solidarity historically begin, which is in the aftermath of the 1967 war. And so moving back to think about this, I told you, the U.S. after this moment is investing in Israel as a Cold War asset in the Middle East, right? Well, the rest of the world is in upheaval against colonialism. By 1960, the world has declared colonialism as an illegitimate form of governance, and so have now come to see colonialism as racism as co-constitutive structures of domination and as a single evil. And so for those revolutionaries across the globe, in the United States, in Mozambique, in Angola, in South Africa, in Namibia, right, they are seeing Palestine as part of a struggle against imperialism globally. So that it's not just Israel. If you see the UN Security Council resolutions at this time, or other resolutions at the GA, the condemnation is of the US because of what it's doing, and specifically its penetration in Vietnam, of Portugal because of its obstinance in Mozambique and Angola, and of Israel. This was seen as an alliance. And so Palestine was a centerpiece of this third world upheaval, and even becomes part of the force, the global force, that makes that basically legislates new law to bring guerrilla warfare into a legal framework that we now know as irregular combat. So they make terrorism into legitimate warfare in 1977 as a part of this era. I'm giving you snippets. I'm going to keep it moving so that we can... This moment begins to dissipate, and the loudness of the Black Palestinian Solidarity Movement, which wasn't just Black Palestine, right? It's what Khoury was telling us. This was about Black transnationalism. This was about understanding the Black radical tradition that understood that freedom for Black people wasn't just in full political sovereignty in the United States, but of creating a new world. It was a project of world-making. Palestine was a critical part of it, but not the only vector in it. And Russell Rickford teaches us that. So I keep dropping these citations for you. Obviously, you're in a classroom, right? But this epic ends in the early 1990s when Namibia, when the SWATO, SWAPO, excuse me, removes apartheid, South Africa, when it removes South Africa, when apartheid falls in South Africa, and when the Cold War ends, and at the same time, the PLO recognizes Israel and enters into the Oslo framework. And now we enter into, I think, what most of you, I would say, this generation has borne witness to, which is the Oslo era, where we come to understand Palestine as a framework of peacemaking, of peace and conflict studies, right? How do we get these two people to just get along? And what drops out from the bottom is an analysis of power. We shifted from an anti-racist justice struggle that clearly could identify power differential and now became this depoliticized framework of conflict resolution.
Right?
And so that era, in my opinion, should have definitively ended in 2001 when the Al-Aqsa Intifada started, when Arafat was placed under siege, when the Camp David talks fell apart. That was my end, okay? Everybody else is still, and people still, are participating in the fiction that the two-state solution is ongoing, right? But it was that, I think, what has made it more clear than ever that era is over was the summer of 2014 and the simultaneous bombardment of Gaza and the occupation of Ferguson, which made clear to most people watching the Israelis don't want a two-state solution. They keep telling us, if anybody would listen, right? There is no longer a Palestinian state. The settlements have eaten it up. No administration is actually brokering peace. Right? And this Trump administration has made that unequivocal if nobody else was paying attention, right? There's no Jerusalem. There will be no right of return for refugees. That this moment, I think that was the turning point for us. It becomes an analytical return. It becomes an analytical return to understanding Palestine as a justice struggle, and a freedom struggle, not within the confines of conflict resolution, and it's an analytical return to these legacies of Black Palestinian solidarity, which we're now engaging in. So I will not have time to do the self-reflexivity project question, but you can ask about that. Thank you.
You have been listening to a forum on Palestinian Black solidarity featuring Professor Nora Aldecott and Dr. Curry Peterson Smith, held at Tufts University. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you'll join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.